Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. It is Thursday, April 16th. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by John Bryce of USA Today, Pete Sampson from The Athletic. We are 2 days away from what is definitely shaping up to be the most informative spring practice of the year, which, as I joked on Monday, will make it the most informative practice of the year probably as well, unless we see something in very, very early August. Pete, I want to throw it to you for, we talk about blue gold games and how they're not quite as important. We can go to Jersey Day memories here over our 2 years of going to the, what is called the Jersey scrimmage, but this should be a good one.
Yeah, it's. I really want to see Carr with the receivers. The chemistry is he starting to show that with Mylon Graham? You know, is there a younger player who can, you know, make some kind of an impact? The clips that Notre Dame has put out, you know, where you get the one-handed Devin Fitzgerald, the one-handed
Finley,
Kaydon Finley. Like, that's, you know, if you can make a play early, even if it's against the twos, then maybe there's something there. So maybe there will be something there on Saturday. I don't know if freshman receivers and returning starter Heisman contenders reps will mesh, but how Carr works with the receivers, I think, is the most interesting thing. You know, defensively, I'll be honest, like, I just think they're going to be really good. And if they're bad on Saturday, it's not going to move the needle for me. Like, I just, that group should be lights out. I'm interested to sort of see Teon Gray and Francis Brew, though, in terms of like how they fit in, how they move.
Maybe anything particular looking for? I know you're coming back in for the scrimmage Saturday.
Yeah, I'm definitely eager to see Will Black, honestly, left tackle. And I'll have a little bit more on some intel from his recent work there here in just a couple of minutes. But really looking forward to that. I'm with Pete. Like, I've heard so much about Brew's just raw strength. I want to see if there's a moment where we notice that Saturday at the Jersey scrimmage. And then obviously, yeah, the receivers are a big thing. And I feel like and continue to hear that three have separated themselves and who emerges after that. So is Saturday a day where Logan Saldate or Elijah Burris or Bubba Frazier, one of those other guys from who I expect to notice, is someone we notice on Saturday? But I'm very intrigued by the offensive line. I mean, Will Black, this is going to be his biggest test to date on Saturday, and we know it's going to be more climactic than what it will be a week later in the blue and gold, whatever you want to call it, game, if you must. But those are the things. And then, you know, I'm always just watching special teams, so I'm curious to see if we see consistently made field goals.
Yeah, and we have a question on that later with Poreth. Pete, your Finley point, I feel like if Kaydon Finley made that catch in practice number one when we were there and we reported it and it was all over Twitter and Notre Dame had that out there, people would have expected more from Finley. But because Finley wasn't the guy that stuck out in that, it was Bubba Frazier that was probably the first guy we saw. And then Devin Fitzgerald, as you said, was the first guy to make a highlight catch that Notre Dame put out there. It's really intriguing to me because guys make one-handed catches these days. We've seen a lot of guys have really good one-on-ones, but Finley's looked like it was in 11-on-11. That's what kind of intrigued me, that he would make that play, because if you don't make plays like that in one-on-one, you're not a modern wide receiver at Notre Dame. You're not that good, but he definitely looked like he did that. If not 11-on-11, you couldn't see the whole field. It was definitely 7-on-7. There were more defensive backs out there.
Yeah, that's like, I go back to, I can't remember the particulars. It somehow involved Chase Claypool and somebody fighting Chase Claypool and a freshman guy.
It was KJ Wallace.
Okay, all right. Well, then this ruins my entire point. But like, I just like, if a freshman like tries, you know, shows some bite early on, all right, you know, that's not everybody can make a one-headed catch. And I realize it's more common, but like, we've seen a lot of Notre Dame receivers come through as like, there's no way he's making a one-handed catch. Give me a break. Like, so if you have freshmen who can do that, not saying that they're going to kick on this season, but I don't know. I'm intrigued by that group. Kaydon Finley was somebody who was singled out to me from somebody inside the Gook very early on. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that I think they were talking about.
Maybe we might as well transition to some of the inside, what do we call it now? Inside the shield? Inside the shields hall. It'll be still inside the Goog for one more year.
Behind the shields, maybe?
Behind the shields, yes, the guard.
Yeah, just particularly from this past Saturday, which was some pretty intense teamwork, and continuing a theme that we know Marcus has even addressed in one of his recent press conferences, the fighting continues. And I was told Jalen Snead was right at the epicenter of it this past Saturday, almost immediately when the team went into a really intense, spirited goal line session. Snead was launching the extracurriculars, but he also apparently had an incredibly good day. I was told he had a couple of different interceptions just pop out of his hand, but that he could have had a couple of picks in a lot of the teamwork this past Saturday, particularly in some of the goal line stuff, and that he just flew around and was maybe the most violent player on the field. And I think there's a lot of violence on the practice field this spring from everyone I've talked to, and from everything I continue to hear about this Notre Dame spring camp. It's edgy, it's chippy, and I do think they're establishing a tone of how they're going to play. I forget what you've called it, but you've made it very clear that this is the revenge tour, and I think that's exactly kind of the groundwork that's being laid. A couple of other just defensive notes that aren't going to surprise anyone, but I was told, quote, 8 and 9 are such erasers back there that secondary just – I mean, this is a coach telling me this. It was just like, you can't believe this secondary, even as a coach, until you get a chance to see it on the practice field. And then I know that Christian Gray really impressed last Saturday with his work in the nickel, and Mark Zachary had a couple of nice plays as well. Switching to the offensive side of the ball and sort of reiterating what I was shared last week, but people doubled down on it. Nolan James, even if he's in a red jersey, is just having an unbelievable spring camp from everyone I talked to. The top three wide receivers continue to be Faison, Gilbert, and Mylon Graham. Mylon Graham continues to just look really, really good. And Will Black, I was told, absolutely had a really good day in pass pro last Saturday and, quote, more than battled with 5 and 95, which we know is obviously Bubakar and Bryce in run blocking. So some very encouraging things along those lines. And then, again, continue to just hear really good things about the Aussie punter and Horath as well. So, but they were heavy, heavy on red zone in that one last Saturday. And then that's kind of the top three that have established themselves. And then I was told that kind of behind those three at wide receiver, you're looking at Cam Williams and then, sorry about this, bad man, Burris. And then that's kind of it for those guys. And then Bubba Frazier. So Bubba Frazier has quickly worked himself into the top second three and among the top six. And I think that echoes what Pete referenced last week.
Pete, I wonder how quickly Jaden Greathouse can reassimilate in August, because it doesn't make any sense if he hurts his hamstring at the beginning of right before spring ball for him to have to be back for the blue gold game or the jersey scrimmage. But I mean, he's the four, right? That's your number four is what you're looking at. He's your number three, really. If you're looking at total snaps, total catches, total plays made, you would think Greathouse would have a healthy Greathouse targeted would be your top three receiver.
I mean, I think the issue there is a healthy Greathouse, you know, and I think Notre Dame in some ways is like, they're kind of preparing to not have him available, because at some point, you know, you can't bank on the guy with the bad hamstring all the time. And if he's available, great. But I mean, I know some people in the group were just like, as they looked ahead to the receiver position, it was just like, okay, if Greathouse doesn't snap back in, it wasn't like a surefire automatically, we're going to have him out there for 35, 45 snaps a game. So I'm not saying that he won't be available and won't have a really good senior year, but I think that they're prepared for him not to be there. You know, that's why you bring in Porter and Graham. So that's why you return basically everybody else. So it's like you have numbers to throw at the problem.
One other quick thing I meant to mention from the offensive backfield, Jonas Walton flashed significantly last Saturday. I was told he had a really impressive run through the heart of the first team defense and would have been a score, and somebody in the back end tackled him inside the five, but just that was a run that stuck with a couple of different people that were there on Saturday.
I think if you listen to last week's podcast, you know who I think tackled him, the fastest player on the team, Leonard Moore. I was surprised that guy was not listed as there, but I know that guy's the fastest when you put the pads on. That's your guy, Jonas Walton, Pete. That was the best call of which freshman, because he has the opportunity right there. In fact, if you're watching the Blue Gold game and you need to have your, I don't know who does a lot of fantasy events for the Blue Gold game, maybe at home, but he is your MVP.
Is there a prop bet available there?
Is your prop bet available? Jonas Walton. He's got to get the ball more than all the other guys are going to in that situation. But he's a confident player. I enjoyed talking to him, actually, in Osborne right before Osborne's surgery. But that really opens the door for Walton. We're going to jump off the field here. Glad we had this times out well with JB, actually. Bryce mentioned that this rule we have talked about often or speculated on for almost a year now is about to pass. And it is, instead of these 5, 6, 7, 8 waivers for years played, it is everybody gets 5 years to play college football for 5 years. Not 5 to play 4 like it used to be, but 5 to play 5. It makes way too much sense for it not to pass, John Bryce, but I'm still surprised it's going to work out.
Yeah, and there was a chance for it to pass yesterday, and the NCAA elected to kick it a little bit further down the road and say we're going to continue dialogue. It's really not about the 5 for 5 at this point. They're trying to decide when they feel they can implement it and not face a torrent of lawsuits. The expectation is August of 27, but that everyone who would have eligibility still going into 27 would then be eligible for a fifth year. So we talked about this in January briefly when I got back from the coaches convention, because the coaches were like, basically it's a fifth year, but we can't call it 5 for 5 because they're worried about lawsuits. But that proposal that the FBS coaches unanimously adopted and endorsed coming out of AFCA was to allow players up to 9 games in a freshman year or a redshirt year and still be able to keep that 4 years of eligibility. This completely does away with that. This gives you 5 to play 5. We've got a pretty expansive story coming out, I think, today at USA Today. I spoke with 10 different people across college football, from the ranks of conference commissioner level to actually got an NFL front office personnel person on the phone to get their perspective of what it might mean for the NFL on all fronts. And then I talked to a number of sitting head coaches and several GMs and directors of recruiting around college football and basketball as well. But the 5 for 5 is you get 5 years. You could play 10 games in one of those years. It would still be a full year. You could play 14 games all 5 years if your team was good enough to be in the playoffs or whatever. You would get those 5 years. It would be it's called age-based eligibility more than anything else. The only knock I've heard on it is people believe it will eliminate the true medical redshirts. And I had a head coach tell me, like, look, that'd be tough if a guy plays 5 games and loses one of his 5 years, but I think it cleans the game up overall. Specifically had another college GM who's also been in the NFL game tell me, like, we've got too many 6th and 7th year guys right now. It's violating the spirit of what it's supposed to be. So that's really intriguing to watch and continue to develop, because if it does get enacted for August of 2027, then you're changing the dynamics of everything. And the coaches I talked to especially were so in favor of it, because they said this changes the way you use the bottom third of your football roster specifically. Now the basketball coaches I talked to had some really interesting thoughts too that should be in the story. But the football coaches were just like, look, man, even when you take transfers, they're not always ready. But they might be able to help you on special teams, and you can have a package for them. And you're like, well, he's got 2 years of eligibility left. Do I waste one of those years when he can do so little? But this, all the coaches I talked to were really in favor of this being a developmentally great thing for all student athletes, but particularly with the coaches I was speaking with on the football front.
Very quick follow-up to that. Let's say, I just look back quickly at the eligibility chart. Let's say it passes August 2027. Okay. Luke Talich is a junior, true junior. He's not redshirted. He plays all next year. No redshirt. He's gone. He can't come back for a fifth year, 5 for 5, because it's passed after his eligibility was used. But Aeneas Williams is a third-year guy, never redshirted. It passes in August 2027. Does he then get a fifth year in August 2028? That would be his senior year. Does that make sense? So
yeah. If you enter 2027, the way it was explained to me, if this rule passes as is expected, and it was enacted in August of 27, which is what was indicated as expected, then even if you went into August or the 2027 season as a true senior, you would get a fifth year at that point in time.
Okay.
Everyone would be grandfathered in. It would just be like, you couldn't have played the 2026 season this pass in August, and you come back and say, well, wait, no, you owe me a year.
Got it. So Alex, no, Williams, yes, is kind of the way to
look at it. Correct.
That's interesting. Pete Sampson, I don't know where you were. I think I do know actually where you were. 19 years and 1 month ago. But on that date, Winthrop defeated Notre Dame 74-64 in the first round of the NCAA tournament. It has taken two decades, but the Irish basketball program has extracted a measure of revenge, I believe, Pete Sampson, by signing Winthrop standout Big South Conference Player of the Year, Logan Duncombe. Originally committed to Indiana from his Cincinnati area. I believe he was Moeller grad. And Pete, do you think they are now even, Notre Dame and Winthrop, for pilfering their best center on Winthrop for the 2027 basketball season?
If you want to believe that, I'm not going to argue you off that position. I mean, look, it's more than a functional big, and yeah, those are really hard to find even at the mid-major level. I mean, I think what, sadly, this no longer applies, because it was like, if they brought back everybody and they could add Paul Atkinson, they've added Paul Atkinson, you know, probably maybe somebody more skilled than Paul Atkinson. Yeah. So it's a bummer that this is kind of a three steps back, but this is the one step forward situation, but it is what it is. You need somebody to be a functional big for you. And I think he's got 2 years of eligibility remaining. So in theory, he'd be here for the next couple seasons, but yeah, I think he led the Big South in free throws made, offensive rebounding, and one other stat, field goal percentage. So he can give you a lot of different things.
And we do still have 5 more days of players eligible to enter the portal and then to continue on trying to work on their roster after that. After we come back from break, I will quickly check just to see. I wrote about this last Friday for USA Today, but at that point in time, there were more than 2,000 Division 1, not all divisions of basketball, more than 2,000 Division 1 basketball players, because I wrote something like, come for a starting point guard, stay for a starting lineup for all 350 Division 1 basketball teams. That's how many players portal as of last Friday afternoon, just in Division 1 men's basketball. I will come when we come back from break. I promise to have an update, because now I've made myself curious.
I got to tell you something though. That actually, it sounds hilarious and I laugh, but in 16, Notre Dame, whenever it was 15, Demetrius Jackson was a sophomore and he stayed at Notre Dame after not a great freshman year. And Georgia Tech's coach at the time, I can't remember who it was.
Asner?
Yes. No, predating him even. He basically said,
Bobby Crummins.
That's awesome. Yeah, Kenny Anderson destroyed Demetrius. He basically said, this guy could have transferred. He stayed at Notre Dame. There are 750 guys that transferred last year when there was no portal. So if there's a portal, I get that there's 2,000. If there's 750 guys a decade ago that transferred in college basketball, I get 2,000 now. It does make sense. I want to throw one more thing before we go to break. I heard this on the radio, so it must be true. No, actually, I was listening to College Sports Radio. A 65% increase in B-ball, in basketball portal contracts this offseason. A 65% increase in pay is what is rumored to have happened in college basketball this year. And they said they are heavily overvaluing big men because of how Michigan built its championship and how Florida built its number one seed. And point guards are getting a little bit devalued compared to the past. And with that, Pete Sampson, I wonder what point forward Jalen Harrelson got from Tennessee.
Yeah. Well, there's The Athletic, CJ Moore, had a good story on just kind of the roster costs by quality of player. And his reporting seemed to indicate, like, at the top of the market, there really wasn't a major adjustment. But it's below that, everyone's trying to get caught up to the top of the market. So I think that's where the 65% is more like, frankly, what Notre Dame is doing. It's not what Michigan is doing. But his reporting is an interesting story. For a borderline starter, $1.5 million. For a locked-on starter, probably $2.5 million. For an all-conference player, $3 million. And for a potential draft pick, closer to $4 million.
You know where I have an issue there? I'm sorry to interject, JB. I only have the issue there with the borderline starter. Everything else makes total sense to me, that you're getting a starter, an all-star, a draft pick. Borderline starter, if you really want to adjust this and you're a GM and you can figure these things out, borderline starter should be half of that. You need to find a way to have half of that with your borderline starters and find the right guys that can play for you for
Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree. I just think
$1,000. I mean, that's
teams are so desperate that they can't help themselves. And it's, you know, I think Swarbrick's old quote was like, if you think winning's expensive, try losing. There's a lot of teams that have been losing, and that gets really expensive really quickly.
Yeah, almost exactly 2,300 now in the just in the NCAA Division I portal. And I don't think that those are active in the portal right now. So I don't think that includes guys who have gone in and then signed and are already considered inactive. In terms of like the Harrelson marketplace, I was told it was north of 3 million when I was told very adamantly that Ohio State had been the first to cross the 3 million threshold with Jalen Harrelson. And I don't think Tennessee is done spending. We know Tennessee spent a lot last year to get Jacoby Gillespie out of the portal and to also sign Nate Ament. I was told they had almost 7 million wrapped up in those two guys. I think I shared that before. And so that's kind of the latest there. Allegedly Notre Dame is trying to crest above 5 million for its men's basketball NIL offerings, which would still put it, you know, way back is almost an unserious program.
We have no transfer portal talk in the second segment, but we do have NFL coaching and on the field stuff coming up in segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Welcome back to segment two. We call it Burning Up the Boards. Our first question is from a phenomenal name joining the podcast for the first time, Adolphus Van Bibber. Someone or something is always overrated by fans and media. With that truth in mind, he is accepting his own truth. With that truth in mind, please answer the following regarding each position group and if it is overrated by the media at present. Your answers can be no, stop talking crazy, yes, I believe this group could be overrated, or simply way too early to tell. Let's go quarterback.
I feel like I'm going to go no, stop talking. Like, I think accurately rated.
Yeah, I would say so too.
I would say at minimum accurately rated, and I would lean towards, I mean, I believe CJ Carr can be an All-American next year. So I would almost lean toward maybe still not rated quite highly enough. You have to keep him healthy. But I think CJ Carr is that good. And I haven't had anyone out of spring camp tell me anything to dissuade me otherwise.
I think he's rated as an All-American. I would say that. I think people are starting to accept that he's one of the potential three All-Americans. I mean, first-team All-American is hard to do because you got to have amazing stats too, but. All right, running back.
I think overrated because I think people think it's just like, they'll be fine. I'm like, I don't know if they will.
I'm going to say, sorry, Tego, go ahead.
I would say at least way too early to tell because I need to see those guys run. They're not going to run. I mean, if you think they're going to be like Love and Price, then you will overrated.
And like, they're not going to, but then we're going to look at the stats and be like, why aren't they doing this? And we're like, well, duh, we told you this. They're not Price and Love. I think it will be a decent room. I think there's a decent amount of thought that, okay, it will be just fine. Like the running game will function just fine without Price and Love. And I'm not totally sure that's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, what do we think the running back room is rated right now? Like that.
I feel like they've gotten a lot of recent publicity that Williams and James, I can insert the joke about being hard to tackle, of course, right here. But they're better than people thought. But if you rank them as nowhere near as good as Love and Price, but could be help the Notre Dame offense in different ways, I think that's the proper way to rate them. They will be helpful in different ways than Love and Price.
Yeah, I think as long as they're rated as a very nice college running back group that is not last year's stupendously elite group, then I would say they're not overrated or too early to tell. But like, in baseball terminology, which I'm not huge, a lot of the new Saber stuff, like war wins above replacement. Well, this is a negative war for this group over last year.
Yeah, there's no comparison between the two. This is a fun one. Wide receiver.
I'm stuck in the middle between overrated and too early to tell.
I'm with you as well because I feel like the whole media and fan base is rating them compared to Notre Dame's poor wide receiver rooms of the recent past.
Yeah. I also think we're just sort of desperate to see good wide receiver play.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they're better than the 2020, 2019, 2020, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25. But that doesn't mean when you get into the final four, they're the playmakers that Miami had last year.
Yeah. I'm fully way too early to tell on that one.
Offensive line. I mean, it's way too early to tell because they have to play together, right?
Yeah, that's the only answer for that one.
That's the line. because they were so overrated last year, I think.
No, that's a bit, but it's way too early to tell no matter what. Like there's, you can't figure that out until defensive line's an interesting one.
I think they're going to be awesome. So I guess that means accurately rated.
Yeah. No, stop talking crazy. That's what that
means. Yeah.
No, stop talking crazy. Linebackers.
No, stop crazy.
But they seem to be very good, and I think they'll be very good.
Yes. Let's just put the secondary as a whole, because it's more. That's really what matters. The secondary as a whole is what matters. You have 10 guys back there rotating. So, I think they're actually rated, and they're really good.
It's freaking ridiculous.
Like, we all agree the defense is higher than the offense, right?
I think the secondary might actually be underrated. How about that?
I was about to say it's not only no stop talking crazy. It's talk crazy more about how good the secondary should be.
It is going to be fun to watch that secondary play. And if Christian Gray or Dallas Golden or DJ McKinney or Jaden Sanders or whoever wants to combine and play some nickel, and they're good at it, if they're Thomas Harper good at it, it's a good defense. That's a good secondary. You don't have to be the best nickel in the country. You just have to be good nickel that you're not getting attacked. And that's.
Since O'Malley ignored the position entirely, I think tight end might be underrated.
Interesting. Really?
Yeah. Underrated by the fact that we weren't even mentioned.
Yeah, that's true. They're much better than that. Are you thinking the addition of Primer, or we're not rating Flanagan and the flaw?
I think Cooper Flanagan will be very good. And I think that the number two, whether it's James Flanagan or Ian Primer, will be very good for a number two in a way that, frankly, I thought the drop-off last year after Eli Raerden was massive, and I don't think they're going to have to run into that this season.
Yeah, and I think Dimbrock and Harris Bibbin working with the tight ends, I think you've got some elite guys that know how to use tight ends well. So I'm not – that's probably the group that understandably maybe has the most question marks, but I also have a lot of faith that that group's going to be a very nice, fine group for Notre Dame.
We go from the best new name to the best old one, Judge Arthur Vandelay. Which team that won yes, his industries are top notch. Which team that won four games or fewer in 2025 will present the biggest challenge for Notre Dame in 2026? Wisconsin, Michigan State, Purdue, North Carolina, Stanford, Boston College, or Syracuse? And yes, over half of Notre Dame's opponents in 2026 won four games or fewer in 2025. Yowza. That's a stat.
Yeah, it's a rough one. I think of that group, I would go North Carolina or Syracuse. I'm not as bullish on Wisconsin as a lot of other people are.
I'm definitely Notre Dame or North Carolina with my top selection for this. I would have Wisconsin number two. I talked to a Big Ten and an ACC guy this week who feels like Wisconsin has a chance to win eight games this year. I tried to bet this person and they didn't. They weren't willing to go that far, but both these people were adamant and that Wisconsin is going to be better than expected. I'm not a believer in that. I don't think that Grimes and some more transfer portal guys are going to immediately fix a Wisconsin program that has just been putrid. I mean, the numbers of Wisconsin against the Big Ten under Luke Fickell are obscene. And now Luke Fickell knows he just lost his best ally with McIntosh announcing that he's on his way out at Wisconsin, which is going to mean the pressure that was already there is going to ratchet up even more. Syracuse feels pretty good. Syracuse does feel like they're going to be one of those bounce back teams that 10 wins was overachieving in 24. Whatever it was last year, four wins was not it, but they think they'll be a 7 or 8 win team.
Well, Syracuse, too. I don't think Michigan State's in a spot on the schedule where Notre Dame can sleep through it at all. If you had to play Michigan State maybe week two with Notre Dame's week two issues, I can't imagine Notre Dame not being raring to go for week three with Michigan State coming into town. That's a rough spot for the Spartans to play Notre Dame. And Purdue's just not – I would jump on the Purdue one because, you know, you just play Michigan State – somewhat physical game, and then you have to go to on the road against another Big Ten team. But I feel like the days of having trouble with Purdue's talent level and Notre Dame are gone. Syracuse is just going to be depressing on all counts, so I'm going with them.
Does that count?
Oh, wait, that's just personal. Yeah, I think Syracuse is the call with a healthy Angeli. They would not have been such a bad team last year, obviously, if Angeli had remained. They got destroyed by injuries.
They had an insane amount of staff turnover. So Notre Dame plays them late in the season, and that should help Syracuse. But whenever you have the same head coach with that much staff turnover in so many different positions coming off of a losing campaign, that does always give me a little bit of pause.
And Notre Dame will have played in a 6-week span, but you know, it's tougher. BYU, Miami, and SMU. So that adds up a little bit more when you go into Syracuse, I think.
Question number three from Kay Beasley. Not a lot has been discussed on how the staff thinks we will open versus Wisconsin at linebacker. Will it be Drake Bowen and Jalen Snead playing a huge majority of the snaps? Will Jay Nosbury play more when base defense is called on? Will Madden Faramo be limited early on? And could someone like Koakia emerge into a rotational snap player? Pete, I thought you were going Petey Pablo a minute ago when you said, I'm going to go North Carolina. I thought you were going to come on and raise up. So we are going to go Pete Sampson first.
I think that it will be Bowen and Snead, with Osbury playing a lot. And then, I don't know, beyond that, Faramo, what does the wrist feel like? First weekend of September probably is, you know, dictates that. But with how much nickel they're in, I don't really think there's a fourth linebacker position. And so, you know, if you're blowing people out in September, which frankly you should, Kia should get a lot of work. But I don't think that work comes in the first quarters.
With KVA out and I think Faramo settling in, I think Bowen and Snead will start and Osbury will have more snaps in September and over the course of the season than Snead.
Yeah, completely.
It's almost three to make two, with Osbury can back up Mike and Will. Yep. And he can be the backup for Bowen and Snead to start the year. That's what they're trying to do right now. I mean, they're working those guys at Mike because they're not used to playing it. And having Bowen and KVA out made that pretty easy.
That's, of course, a Sunday opener, and it looks like it's going to be an afternoon game based on some of the other TV selections that have already been announced. And so if you have heat that Sunday afternoon, maybe you have a little more early rotation with Faramo and Kia. But otherwise, I mean, the stuff I've heard on Snead and his spring and Drake Bowen and just how lock steady he is, and then Osbury being so versatile to as well, I think it's an early lean to those three.
And I want to point out for people wondering, Faramo, red jersey. We assume we'll see him in red jersey. He will be in a red jersey throughout the spring. He's working at middle linebacker right now. So that's a crowded house, but I'm sure he has learned to play Will as well. Faramo, when he is healthy, he's really high on my list. So I'm not trying to disparage his playing time at all. I'm just thinking for week one, that's a rough injury to come back from. And you have veterans that can play three of them to make two spots. Next question from Andy Yinzer. It's draft related. Two of them, over under, 3.5 Notre Dame players drafted before the end of day two. He says Love, Price, and Fields are your givens. So do you believe Schroth, Wagner, or Raritan could sneak in before Saturday? And over under overall, 6.5, adding those three as accepted draft picks.
I think I'd go under on both. Raritan is intriguing to me. I know, was it Nate Tice who does some draft stuff? Had him as a top 50 player overall, which is not something I've seen anywhere else.
Yeah.
But I was like, if when in doubt, I default to Dane Brugler, my colleague at The Athletic, and his projections would have Notre Dame with the three guys going, one guy on day one, two guys on day two, three guys on day three, and that would be a wrap.
I tend to agree. So the three guys that could be drafted would be Pauling with that 4-3-7, Devonta Smith, and Jalen Stroman. I do not see Smith and Stroman getting drafted. That, of course, has nothing to do with becoming a good NFL player. 485 players in the NFL last year were not drafted. It's a lot. 485.
Yeah, I think Pauling, I think that Notre Dame Pro Day number and just his body of work will get him a seventh round selection.
That'd be good. He's and as Pete has said a couple times, and we talked about it, Pete, he's the J.D. Bertrand of this year. He's going to beat someone. Wherever he goes, it's somebody. Whatever he ends up at his free agent camp or seventh-round picks, those wide receivers that are backups are probably in a little bit of trouble because Will Pauling's going to outwork you. Next question from Dip98. With Spencer Porath coming to Notre Dame from Purdue without entering the portal, does he fall into the category of ghost portal transfers that could result in penalties listed as written below? Why or why not? The quote now is, the NCAA Division I cabinet on April 1 approved emergency legislation that will severely penalize coaches of schools that sign, add to the roster, or allow athletic participation by an athlete in any sport who hasn't yet gone through the portal process. The penalties include a suspension for the head coach for 50% of the season and a fine amounting to 20% of the sports budget. Those are some legit fines. They are not playing around, John Bryce.
Yeah, this is included in my content today on USA Today because it was passed April 1st and then informally ratified yesterday, Wednesday.
That's quicker than usual.
Yeah. Well, it was the NCAA itself said it was passed April 1st in an emergency maneuver. There's conflicting opinion speculation out there about whether or not this would stand up in court, that lawsuit would be challenged because they said what happens to a guy. And one of the examples that was used to me was Jake Retzlaff at BYU, and he was facing a 7-game suspension from BYU for their conduct code, personal conduct code, even though I think the charges were dropped or the allegations went away. But he was still facing a 7-game suspension. So he just unenrolled from BYU and enrolled as a walk-on at Tulane. The other guy, his name escapes me, who went from the defensive back who went from Wisconsin to Miami, also just unenrolled and then enrolled in Miami, and Wisconsin tried to sue. And yeah, I think under the new interpretation of this, that Porath would be viewed in that regard, especially if Purdue wanted to push towards that. And you would have to talk to the Purdue coaches to know. And I think a lot of people believe, okay, this is inevitably going to happen to me, but I'm also inevitably going to benefit from this at some point. So then it comes back to, is a school willing to say, no, that's a ghost transfer, I want to press this to the max, because we would never do that. So that is, it is though, the about the quickest we've ever seen legislation like that, punitive legislation, move through the NCAA. And it's some of the harshest that the NCAA has on its record. Because look, when you're Texas, Ohio State, Notre Dame, Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, all these teams that are more than $100 million football budgets, then you're talking about a $20 million plus penalty if you're found guilty, in addition to the 6%. Now, we can debate whether or not a ghost transfer should cause a suspension of the head coach far more severe than anything Jim Harbaugh and the Michigan Wolverines endured for their widespread orchestrated Connor Stallions scandal. But I guess that's a different podcast. And certainly you can't tell how I feel about that. Go ahead.
I just love it when a kicker doesn't play against Notre Dame and how we used to talk about it in the past, Pete. We were out in Pittsburgh, remember? Late stretch. Oh, yes. Yes.
And the BC kicker. I mean, there's like, yes,
somebody might be coming to Notre Dame soon.
Yeah.
It ended up being the guy we didn't know about for Purdue, Spencer Porras.
Shoot it into the zeitgeist, yeah.
You're up, JB.
I know. All right. From my guy, Sports Talk Drew, regular Twitter interactor as well, or the platform formerly known as Twitter. Please rank the following defensive tackles by total snaps next season: Brew, Onye, Hughes, Gray, Burgess, Mookum, and all others combined. I had opened last time with Pete. This time, Sir O'Malley, it is you.
Brew 1, Gray 4, Onye and Hughes so close it doesn't matter. I'll just give the nod to Onye here. I think Hughes is going to play a lot more than Hughes. Only played like 100 fewer snaps than Onye last year, and he didn't start playing until like week 5. So that's why, if people are wondering why I'm close on that one, I'll go with an upset. Brew 1, Hughes 2, Onye very close 3, Gray 4, Burgess just ahead of Mookum when all is said and done, and Mookum ahead of all the other guys combined.
I'd say Sports Truck Drew has them in order as is. Brew, Onye, Hughes, Gray, Burgess, Mookum, everybody else.
Yeah, I was maybe going to go Brew, Onye, Gray, Hughes, Burgess, Mookum, everybody else, but I think you look at 4 and then you can almost lump all the others together.
Yeah, it'd be nice if they get something out of, like, Burgess is the late season call up, is kind of what I was looking for here.
I think they have to get something out of Burgess, whether he's ready or not, because they need Burgess to stick around.
Oh, that's important too. Yeah. You know, you can pay guys too. That's one way of doing it. It's not cheating anymore.
Yeah, you could. I just think you want to play at some point.
Yeah, it's true. No, that's a good point. And that actually is going to deal into that actually comes into a question here we have down the line. Fact that it is not down the line, it is coming up right now from Nicodemus. This is the time of year we're all focused on the incoming freshmen and our way too early projections and rankings. I'd like your take on the current sophomores instead. I really like this question, guys, because that is the smallest class. That is the class that will now traditionally be purged due to the portal. and decisions that have to be made. And it is, I think there's 17 players remaining in the current sophomore class, and those are all signees, no transfers. Guys, other than, let's leave Nolan James out of it, because we've talked plenty about Nolan James, and obviously he's our number one sophomore here. How about, aside from Nolan James, who do we kind of overlook so far in the sophomore class?
Ooh, I don't know. I mean, it's like we talk about everybody so much, it's hard to overlook anybody. I think if we had to pick a overlooked sophomore, I'd probably go James Flanagan. Because it's like, ooh, they've got this new five-star freshman coming in. Like, I don't know. I think James Flanagan's got a chance to be quite good at Notre Dame. I'm not saying he's going to start this year, but that'd be the guy for me that I'd pick out.
Isn't Cole Mullins a sophomore?
No, junior. Junior.
He's listed as a sophomore.
Notre Dame is
just like, yeah, I'm just looking at the recruiting class.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah. All right. And I have a hard time disagreeing with.
Yeah, that's true. You just want to get the name in.
I really did just want to get Cole Mullins on the podcast.
I mean, the only guy we could really overlook that's really good that could play, and you don't want it to happen because I think an injury would have to occur, would be Ethan. I think Ethan Long's a really good player. I also think Joey O'Brien's right there behind him. And if Joey O'Brien and Ethan Long were the same class, I wouldn't be having this conversation. Joey O'Brien would be ahead of Ethan Long. So he's just in a tough spot with, but, you know, he's a guy that, he can now. He's a developmental player that can help Notre Dame because Tay Johnson can go pro next year. Don Shuler will go pro next year. You can have a year with Luke Talich will be out of eligibility next year, so you can have a year of Ethan Long and Joey O'Brien in there as well. That would be mine, as Pete said, and Priester's talked about this a few times. We talk about a lot of players, so it's really hard to overlook someone. I would say Ethan Long because so many players are good ahead of him is the guy we overlook a little bit. Two-parter here, and Tally Alley. Congratulations, and thank you very much for your persistence and patience. This is a really hard question to answer. Assuming Kingston Viliamu-Asa returns 100% healthy, does he have a higher ceiling this year compared to last year coming off injury? Can you recall a player missing the spring due to injury and being better than he was when he was injured the previous year? Pete, we were having some trouble pre-podcast on this.
Yeah. Did Kevin Austin miss a spring? Because he was like
spring before he's broke out.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of the only one that comes to mind. And I'm not 100% certain he misses spring, but I'm sure he was limited in spring because they're just like, we're not going to break your foot again.
Yeah.
But and then went on to have a
great,
not great, but like really, really good final year. So that's probably the one that comes to mind. But it's a good question because there aren't a lot of answers for it.
Lloyd was suspended. He does not count. We're not talking about suspended players.
We discussed pre-show in our pre-production meeting, Boubacar Traore. You know, I mean, he was injury and missing spring of 25 and then was a very, very good football player by the time the 2025 season ended. Some of that, I think, is just natural progression, injury or otherwise. Like, Boubacar was a very young player still in 2025, I think. As much as we've seen KVA flash, he's still going to be a very young player in terms of true experience in 2026. But I do like I'm incredibly bullish on his ceiling. And I know that people on the current Notre Dame coaching staff have said that he can be a first round draft pick in 2027. Now that was pre-injury, so we have to see exactly how he comes back. But that gives you an idea of what this staff believes of KVA's potential.
A question. We talked about this pre-production as well. This is a fancy name we have for the 5 minutes before this podcast talks.
You're welcome.
Riley Leonard did miss the spring of 2024 due to injury. I don't know. Was he better? He got him in the championship game. I don't know. He might have been more dynamic at Duke. So Riley Leonard is a player that missed all of the spring due to injury, due to a very bad injury in the middle of the season the year before. That's one I can think of. I want to point out this is a great question because as of 10 years ago, it wasn't a possibility if you tore your ACL during the 2025 football. If you tore your ACL in the 2014 football season and missed all the spring, you probably weren't going to be all the way back in 2015 for the football season. But nowadays, you are back in 9 months. Achilles makes it harder. If you just want to deal with KVA.
Boom. I got one.
Got one?
Jared Patterson. Jared Patterson missed spring practice for a weight room injury, came back. Had a great final season.
All right. So they're good. They're all set. And I couldn't figure out with Kevin Austin. Kevin Austin re-injured his foot in late November versus Pitt in the 45-3 game that week. So he wasn't playing, but he re-injured his foot. I bet he missed spring also.
Yeah, that was that a foot also for Patterson, Pete? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, well, I think he had a foot and a pec.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the pec was maybe in the spring, and then he had a foot in the fall. So it like
he had a
great too. Second half of his senior year, yeah. But it was not because he missed spring practice.
Right. You know what? In fact, he hurt that foot to start August, and he missed Ohio State and Marshall, which you would not have coupled in the past, but now we can couple those two games because that was unfortunately. But he was not there for that. Great question from Tally Alley. POTUS on Sports wants to add to it. Odds he now comes back for a fourth year, which was not going to happen. Right, guys?
I think that's too soon to tell from a previous question.
Yeah, that's right. Stealing the answering scale from very early.
Very we early can use that from now on. Every time we need to do something per scale here, we just go, yeah, it's too soon to tell. I don't have an answer. Yeah,
if he's the KVA that has just unbelievable bend and does things that are kind of insane for 6'3" player his size, then I don't think so. But you know, does he come back and play great from October 17th on, from the BYU game on? Does he play just a little bit right before that and then start with BYU and play great, and Notre Dame has four playoff games and he's great every one of those? I don't know that he comes back at that
scenario. No, I would not think so. But it changes from there was a 0% chance healthy KVA would come back after 3 years to, well, at least you could look into it now, because it certainly wasn't going to happen if he didn't get hurt. Final question, MJB in California or in CA. I believe it was the April 2nd podcast where the team opened the door to speculating about the future of college athletics. I think we're the team. So I am walking through that door. Where do you see college football in the next 5 to 10 years? In other words, are athletes employees? And where does Notre Dame fit into such a future?
I mean, things move so slowly. I think college football is going to just keep putting off the whole athletes as employees thing, even though it would solve a lot of problems. I don't know. I think the sport's just going to sort of keep limping along. And people are going to watch it. We're going to podcast about it. It's going to be incredibly popular. And so no huge structural changes will happen. And John, you probably could speak more on this than I did. Like, even this like conference realignment type stuff, like, I'm not sure where the realignment happens other than like Super League type stuff at this point. Like, is it Clemson, Florida State, Miami, North Carolina, like those kinds of schools? But like, where do they go? I don't know.
Yeah. Again, this ties in. So much of my travels yesterday were spent working on that story and having these very similar conversations, because the 5 for 5 ties into the presidential order that's supposed to take effect in, I guess, in August.
It's almost as if I like tie these questions in at the right time.
Yeah. I know. Sometimes I feel like you listen to me. Wait, what'd you say? I think there's more realignment coming. I was told adamantly, actually, when I talked to Brian Kelly this week, he said it's absolutely coming when the contracts are up, which I think is around 2028. I think the ACC expects to lose some teams. I know of a couple of programs the ACC expects fully to add at that point in time. I don't get the sense, and none of the information out there suggests that college student athletes wish for the employee label because of, you know, the potential negative ramification. I know Pete Bavacqua has talked candidly about it. I know Jack Swarbrick prior to Pete talked about it. Pete, at one point, I think, said he had met with over 500 student athletes and not one had said he or she wanted to be an employee. I think I'm right on that. I know that they've addressed it and that Pete and Jack have both adamantly emphasized they don't have student athletes coming to them saying, make us employees. But what was pointed out to me yesterday is that, and I referenced this last week on the pod, that, quote, there's a reckoning coming in college athletics. And that reckoning is still coming, and it's going to continue to come as private equity. I'm not smart enough to figure this out. I had a head coach point this out to me. Like, when you get private equity involved, and now private equity has bought Learfield or is buying Learfield, which owns so much of the media properties for college athletics around the country. Well, private equity doesn't invest in charitable endeavors. Like, private equity is investing in you for an ROI, which means
they're not paying $1.5 million for a borderline basketball starter.
No, don't do that. No, nope.
Correct. So, I mean, the point was just hammered home to me yesterday specifically that, like, This private equity, and Utah already has announced its very extensive private equity deal. Private equity is going to invest in football and men's and women's basketball and not really care about a lot of the other sports unless they're an outlier sport that is specific to that school or that region that can make money. So it's
for Notre Dame?
Like what was specifically? Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And at some points in the past, hockey for Notre Dame as well. You know, baseball at Vanderbilt was an example used to me yesterday. And this head coach questioned me. He said yesterday, how long do we continue to see that? Is it the Crimson Tide brought to you by the University of Alabama? Does it become the Fighting Irish presented by Notre Dame? And I know Notre Dame is staunch in its opposition to that. But coaches I spoke with this week thinks that's what it's trending toward at the upper level, particularly. They said, see what money comes out of the next NFL contracts. Watch how college football responds to that, and you'll get your answer. So hopefully I didn't talk in too many circles there or provided some information. So I do think there's a reckoning coming. I've heard too many people talk about it. The money is not sustainable. It's especially not sustainable when you're trying to give more of your rev share to your student athletes from those programs that actually generate the revenue. So I still think there's more of a D3 model coming for the non-revenue sports. And I know some folks at Stanford have pushed for the D3 model for basically all sports except for men's and women's basketball and football. And I think we'll continue to drift closer to that.
There's also a reckoning coming this Saturday in the form of the jersey scrimmage. And you can read about it at USA Today, The Athletic, and of course, IrishIllustrated.com. And most important, no offense, Irish Illustrated Instant Analysis Parts 1 and 2 should be coming up as well after that reckoning on April 18th. For Pete Sampson, The Athletic, John Bryce of USA Today, I am Tim O'Malley. Thanks for watching and listening, Irish Illustrated Insider.